The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. This story is Dragon Rising by S.E. Gilby. Alex came from a good family, the kind that sits straight-backed in the front pew at church and makes it very clear that they are listening properly to the sermon. Their father was a banker, who was very fond of meetings. Their mother volunteered for a charity for disadvantaged children. Alex's siblings were much older, a daughter and a son who'd left home as soon as they could and seldom returned to visit. Alex was adopted, a disadvantaged child from their mother's charity. A mistake, their mother admitted to her best friend in a moment of weakness that she soon regretted, for her best friend was a terrible gossip. We didn't need a third child. Regibald didn't even want a third child, but no one else wanted her, and I thought it was our duty. Alex grew up obsessed with dragons. Dragon was their first word. They used to run through the fields trying to follow the wild dragons that flew overhead. They read every book about dragons that they could find in the library and drew endless pictures of them. When they were old enough, they studied them at school. "When I grow up, I want to be a dragon keeper," Alex declared at breakfast one morning. "Well, they won't have you," their mother said. "They don't employ girls for those kind of jobs. Far too dangerous." "I'm not a girl," Alex pointed out. "Not today." "Not today, no. But who knows what you'll be tomorrow?" And that was the problem with Alex, as far as everyone was concerned. The reason why no one else would adopt them. The reason why their mother regretted taking them in. Velkensianism, the charity's doctor had diagnosed, also known as fluctuating gender, a most unusual condition. The child must have been exposed to a large amount of magic when in the womb. "But what gender is it?" their mother had asked, exasperated. "That will depend from day to day." "But what are we to put on the birth certificate?" "Both? Neither?" Instead, their mother decided to put down that Alex was a girl and then tried to raise them as such. It did not go well. "Dragons change gender, too," Alex had pointed out as soon as they were old enough to know this. "They can be boys or girls or neither, depending on how they feel about it." "Well, you're not a dragon, are you?" their mother hissed. It only got worse as Alex approached adolescence and it became impossible for their parents to disguise that they weren't always a girl. The local villagers grew increasingly alarmed by this strange child in their midst. "Who knows what kind of person the birth mother was?" Harvey, the landlord of the Drunken Stout, demanded to know one evening when his pub was full of locals letting off steam at the end of a tedious day's work. "I don't hold with this kind of thing at all," Betty, the school nurse, replied. She didn't normally drink during the week, but Alex had come to her that day with a migraine, and she was quite unsettled. "It's not respectable. They should send the child away. It would be much better for everyone." In the end, that's exactly what Alex's parents did. After the village children had grown to bullying Alex so badly that Alex ended up with a broken arm. But the boarding school they sent Alex to was no better. They were sent home by the indignant nuns after only a couple of weeks. "It's an all-girls school," the mother superior coldly informed Alex's parents. "We don't accept boys." "But she's a girl," Alex's mother protested. "Not all the time." "Couldn't you at least have pretended?" Alex's mother dragged Alex into the car with a bruising grip. "No," Alex replied. They weren't paying attention to their mother, but to the flight of wild dragons flying overhead. "Well, you'll just have to go to the local comp." No private school will have you. Not now. Word's got out about you. The local comprehensive school was in the nearest large town. It was hell on earth for Alex. As much as possible, they skived off and spent their time playing by themselves in the woods. There, no one looked for them. They made friends with the local wild dragons who learned to look for them and would surround Alex in a rainbow of swirling magic. Alex would read stories to them and sing songs, and the dragons would try to teach Alex their magic. Meanwhile, Alex's parents were unraveling. They were being shunned by the villagers because of Alex. Their mother was asked not to volunteer for the charity anymore. At the bank, their father found himself sidelined, excluded from important meetings. Then there was a campaign to get Alex and their family to leave the village. "But my family has lived here for 100 years. Alex's mother was horrified. The campaign was secretive and spiteful, and no one really knew who was behind it. There were posters put up. "Keep our children safe," said one. "What if it's contagious?" asked another. No one openly approved of the campaign, nor of the brick thrown through the family's kitchen window, nor of the paint thrown over the father's expensive car. No one said out loud the things that the campaign was suggesting. But no one did anything to stop the campaign, either. No one bothered to find out who had started it. It was Miss Pettison, a sweet old retired lady whose amiable smile hid a deep well of bitterness and spite. Besides, once the campaign got started, most of the villagers took surreptitious part. It wasn't Miss Pettison who threw the brick, nor the paint. Alex disappeared just before their 14th birthday. Their parents let it be known that they'd sent their child abroad to a religious institution that didn't mind fluctuating gender. "They're much more accepting of that kind of thing over there," their mother told her best friend, Miss Pettison, who had shown her loyalty by continuing to visit throughout the entire nasty business. "Alex will be happier and doing God's work, which is so important." Miss Pettison seriously doubted that God wanted Alex doing his work, but she kept quiet and nodded her head and sipped her tea. She knew that Harvey would express that thought for her when she told him everything later, down at the Drunken Stout. As time passed, Alex's parents gradually became accepted into village life once more. Their father was invited to meetings again. Their mother rejoined the charity. They visited their two older children in the city. Their daughter gave them their first grandchild. Their son got engaged to be married. They sat straight-backed in the front pew at church on Sundays and listened intently to the sermon. Nearly a year passed. The fire happened on a Monday night, and only Alex's parents were home. The fire burned so ferociously that the home was a blackened shell by the time the firefighters had put it out. They found two bodies in the rubble of the bedroom, and a third one in what would have once been the coal cellar. "They'd locked Alex up in there," Betty, the school nurse, told an astonished audience in the Drunken Stout. She was dating one of the firefighters, and he'd told her everything. All that nonsense about finding some foreign place as would take them, that was all lies. "So then it was Alex as set the fire?" Harvey asked. "No, it couldn't have been. There was nothing in the cellar they could have used to start a fire, not even any coal, ironically. Besides, Alex died too." "It might be for the best," Harvey mused. "At least we can all sleep safe in our beds tonight." The others agreed. Only Miss Pettison shed a tear for the death of her good friend, Alex's mother. They never did find out how the fire had started. No one had noticed the wild dragons flying high above the house that night. Dragons are often drawn to fires, and the firefighters were focused on trying to tame the flames. They never thought of dragon fire nor of dragon magic. No one noticed the new dragon hatchling that emerged from the flames, Alex reborn. No one heard over the roar of the fire the joyful song with which the flight of wild dragons welcomed Alex into their midst. And no one saw them fly far, far away from the burning home, never to return.
Hello, this is Carrie Lawson reading Body and Soul by Philip Wiltgren. Gail chose Body. I never expected her to. We'd been so adamant about our minds, how the soul is worth more than the flesh. And yet she chose Body. The treatment took her back to her early 20s, physically. Her hair, that she'd started coloring before her 59th birthday, reverted back to the glimmering strawberry blonde it had been when we first met. Her figure followed, muscles regaining their tone, chin firming up, breasts lifting. She laughed a lot. "Come on, Mark," she said. "Admit that you've always wanted to bed a 20-something." I humored her, and she laughed more, throwing off her jeans and twirling before me, her open shirt billowing like a black cape. She grasped my coarse face and pressed her lips to mine. "When you make up your mind, we can be gorgeous together," Gail said. "I'll dance, and you'll play the violin. It'll be like old times." I didn't reply, merely looked at my roomy hands, twisted with age and disease. I'd never play the violin again, because I'd made up my mind already. I'd chosen soul. The treatment was easy, a series of injections over 3 weeks, some migraines and not very bad ones. I felt the world taking on focus, becoming clear. The Times crossword puzzles became ridiculously simple. "Come on, Mark," Gail said. "Just choose." I tried to make myself smile. I failed. "Oh, honey," she said. "It's better than the hype. Look." She stood on her toes without her ballerina shoes, assumed first position, then lifted her leg up, flowing into an arabesque. Her smile was radiant. "No pain," she said. "Not even a bit." She took my hands in hers, her smooth, straight, pink fingers running over my twisted, arthritic ones. "Don't you want to play again?" she said. I nodded, but I didn't say that I'd chosen. My 73rd birthday came and went. Gail celebrated with a huge chocolate cake, a thick coating of cherry-laced mascarpone covering the top. She ate most of it herself. No need to worry about cholesterol or fat. The treatment took care of all that. "Mark," she said, "you're going into the prime. 72 is the optimal age for the injections. You've got to choose now." Her voice was so honest, so full of life and vigor. "Gail," I said, "I'm 73. She paused, fork overflowing with pink frosting halfway to her mouth. "Huh," she said. "Imagine that. You'd better choose fast then." "I have," I said. We had a huge fight after that. I caught her looking. You could always tell the new young from the truly young. The new young moved like they were afraid, like life had broken them, and they weren't able to believe they'd been spared. Even Gail had that, for all her joy. When she wasn't bouncing, she'd sag, her shoulders hunching, her head bobbing forward, her gaze fixated a yard or two in front of her feet. She was fascinated with youth, and new youth especially. The new young were never fat, never pimply, never questioning. They moved like broken gods, muscular, strong, healthy, but slow and careful. They walked as if expecting to fall down at any moment. Sometimes they just sit, filling up the park benches and staring emptily ahead. Sometimes you'd see a true young with a new young, sometimes a pair of new young or too young of mind. There were couples like us, one new young, one young of mind. They seldom looked happy. Gail kept looking, following the young and the new young with her gaze. I didn't begrudge her. I knew what I looked like. But it still hurt. It's not like I'm doing anything, she said. But the distance between us kept increasing. One day she packed a pair of suitcases and moved out. We agreed it was nobody's fault. I got postcards, real physical ones, France, Mexico, China. I got emails with short clips, Gail walking in Zambia, climbing the Matterhorn, drinking an iced latte on a Canary Island beach. She looked beautiful in them, beautiful and bewildered. My body hurt, but my mind was sharp. I started teaching again, using a pre-programmed keyboard when I couldn't play. I wrote poetry and stayed up at night watching the clouds. I won the state bridge championship and placed 80th in the non-AI National Go tournament. Gail sent me a selfie giving me the thumbs up. After a while, postcards stopped coming. The emails came less often. Sometimes they came from other accounts. Sometimes Gail sent a selfie with some new young groups of handsome men and women. Sometimes she was hugging a man or being hugged. That hurt. I watched the new young in the park. You could tell how old they were by how empty their faces were. Sometimes they'd jerk as if surprised at finding themselves in such surroundings. The young of mine never did. We knew where we were, how we'd gotten there and why. One day I watched a new young drooling for 2 hours before the emergency services took her away. Walking became painful. My health plan paid for a set of muscle pants. They're cotton doped with electropolymers that reinforced my motions. I was trying them out when the hospital called. Gail had a bruise discoloring her left cheek. She was staring out the window where gray clouds tried to cover the building with drizzle. Walked into the street, the nurse said. Got hit by a transport drone. Medical records list you as next of kin. My wife, I explained. A brief look of sadness passed over the nurse's bearded face. My father was like that, he said. Gail jerked. Mark, she said. Then she went back to staring out the window. The nurse pursed his lips. My father, he said. Didn't last long beyond that. I nodded, taking Gail's smooth hands in my knobbly, hurting ones. Dad, she said, I thought you'd left. No, I said, I'll always be here for you.
This is Dan Oliver reading Let's Pretend by Mary Soon Lee. Let's pretend this is about two other people. Call them Ada and Jane. Ada was an overweight, sarcastic software engineer, fed up with people assuming that because she was black, she must have dodged drug dealers on the way to school. Jane waited tables in a Thai restaurant, the customers barely noticing her even when they placed their orders. But Ada noticed Jane, and ate at the restaurant every Saturday for 3 months before finally asking her out. Soon after, they moved in together, and everything was as close to perfect as anything ever is. Being with Jane brought out Ada's paranoid protective streak. She stockpiled food, water, batteries, and first aid supplies in the basement. She bought life insurance. She analyzed consumer safety reports before buying Jane a Volvo for her daily commute. When the aliens first manifested, Ada bustled Jane down to the basement. When the diet of tuna fish and news reports palled, Jane suggested that they return upstairs since the aliens hadn't hurt anyone. They simply manifested out of empty air, in pairs, lingered for a few minutes, maybe brushed a plump purple tentacle across someone's shoulder, then vanished again. Ada liked Jane's optimistic, trusting nature, but she didn't share it. She suspected the aliens of planning a mass invasion. She imagined weapons smaller than a fingernail concealed in the folds of the aliens' corpulent purple bodies. She imagined a fleet of alien spaceships bombarding every major city. She imagined alien computer viruses infiltrating the Internet. When no evidence of her fears emerged in the first few days, Jane talked her into leaving the basement. For 6 more weeks, everything was nearly as close to perfect as it had been before. Aliens manifested in thousands of places. They didn't make threats, nor offer gifts, nor ask questions. They didn't communicate at all until they recruited their first 2 humans, a 13-year-old boy from a Guatemalan village and a quiet-spoken older man from Hamburg. The Guatemalan boy had been playing soccer with his friends. He told his friends that the aliens had asked him to be their helper. None of the other boys heard the aliens speak. None of them believed his explanation that the aliens had spoken inside his head. So it proved a surprise when the aliens manifested the following day and took the boy away. Ada found the news deeply disturbing. She pictured the aliens performing perverse experiments on their human victim. Jane merely said she hoped the boy would be happy. The German man, recently retired, told his sister that the aliens wished him to go for an indefinite stay as a helper-guide-companion. He asked his sister if she had any objection to his leaving, and, having received her blessing, he too vanished into thin air with a pair of aliens. 3 evenings later, while Ada and Jane ate chicken tikka masala on the sofa, a pair of aliens manifested beside the bookshelves. Ada jumped up and stepped in front of Jane and said a lot of things she didn't remember while she eyed the living room for possible improvised weapons. A vase? A laptop? In case of a direct attack. Jane, sitting quietly behind her, said after a minute, "Thank you. I have to think about it." The pair of aliens flattened their plump purple tentacles against their plump purple bodies and vanished. Ada grabbed Jane. "Are you all right?" "Fine," said Jane. "They want me to go with them." Let's pretend that Ada and Jane talk things over calmly and reasonably. Jane explained that the alien who spoke to her was sensorially impaired, unable to see or feel the physical world. It wanted a puppet, a pawn, a human through whose mind it could navigate mundane physical reality, while its own mind consorted on an elevated mental plane with the other aliens. Jane described this in favorable terms, expounding the alien's kindness and concern and patience, and above all, how much it needed her. Jane didn't glow as she spoke, but she came as close to glowing as a person can. Despite this, Ada voiced, with feeling, the thought that if an alien cripple wanted a guide dog, it could look elsewhere. The calm and reasonable discussion went on past midnight. At last, Jane committed the unforgivable sin of saying, "You decide. I won't go unless you agree. I won't go unless you promise not to mope afterwards." Ada calmly and eminently reasonably stalked out of the house and went to an all-night bar. A few shots of whiskey clarified her mind amazingly. I think you should know that Jane's careful arguments didn't sway her, nor did the realization that if Jane stayed, she would either resent Ada, bad enough, or else would forgive Ada, worse. No, a rare servicing of Ada's better nature undid her. She saw at the bottom of the 5th shot of whiskey that she loved Jane. And so what she wanted was what Jane wanted, which was as complicated a thought as the whiskey allowed. Ada went back to Jane and told her this. She threw in promises about not moping, getting on with her life, and knowing that Jane would always love her. So the aliens took Jane away. Let's pretend that Ada kept her promises, that she didn't mope, that she didn't get demoted, that she didn't wake up in the middle of the night to compose endless letters that Jane would never read. Over the next 11 months, the aliens took away 173 more people. The people ranged from 10 years old to 92. Some were rich, others poor. Six were notably clever, three played the guitar, five were nurses, one had a stutter. No one has found any statistically significant commonality among them, except that they were uniformly described as nice, quiet, a little shy. None of the people have ever come back. But it's only been 18 years. Perhaps that's not long to an alien. Let's pretend that I will find out how to send this letter to you, together with all my earlier letters. Let's pretend that after reading my messages, you will come home. And whatever you say and however you look at me, that day will be as close to perfect as I will ever want.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and this is Earth's Lament by Avery Elizabeth Hurt. Yes, they are getting out of hand and will likely do themselves in sooner rather than later, and take not a few others with them when they go. Earth sighed and looked around. And you, dear? Jupiter asked. Will you be okay? Always solicitous, he refilled her glass without being asked. Oh, yes, I'm always fine. These infestations come and go. Anaerobic bacteria, invertebrates, dinosaurs. Actually, the change is refreshing. But these humans have been charming in their way, and certainly entertaining. They have become convinced that their desperate efforts to save themselves are actually attempts to save me. As if I can survive only in the conditions they need to survive. They've transferred their own terror of annihilation into a touching concern for me. It's really rather sweet.
Sounds more than a little self-involved, if you ask me, Jupiter said.
Earth picked up her glass and took a delicate sip. Well, yes. That is rather the problem, isn't it? I must admit, though, I'll hate to see them go.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.